Welcome everybody to All About Symbian, Insight number 165, recording this on Monday the 9th of May 2011. I'm Steve Litchfield for the site. With me and down in Sussex I have
Rafe Blanford.
And up in Hull,
it's David Gus, and Emerson's out here.
Oh, hooray. I won't say that's unusual for Hull. I'm sure I'm doing you a great disservice. Ewan is off working for some radio station doing Eurovision Song Contest. He's still away on his fortnight away, but he should be back for next week's Insight podcast. But we'll plough on without him. First news item, IDC, the analysts, have released its first set of smartphone shipment figures for quarter one 2011, kind of backing up some of the figures we got from Nokia's own results call. Just under 100 million smartphones were sold last quarter across the industry. Nokia led the way with 24 million, followed by Apple 18.7, RIM 13.9, and Samsung 10.8, with HTC then following at 8.9. So Nokia still clearly in the lead, but Nokia's average selling price is quite a bit less than, for example, Apple's, and there's quite a bit less profit coming in. Rafe, do you want to talk us through the figures and the charts?
Yes, I mean, as you say, this is building on some of the results we had earlier from the various manufacturers, but it's always interesting to get the independent figures from IDC. Whenever you're reading these, you should bear in mind that they will always vary from the manufacturer figures a little bit. It depends how you define shipment, who's doing the counting, etc., etc. And, for example, IDC often seem to have a bigger estimate for the overall market volume than, say, Nokia do. And some of the other manufacturers as well. And each of those companies obviously has put a lot of effort into getting these figures accurate. But nonetheless, they're all about the same. I think probably the interesting item here for a lot of people will be the market share figures, because it's a good way, obviously, of comparing the various companies. As you mentioned, Nokia is ahead on 24.3%. But I think the big point there is that sees an almost 13% drop year on year. So, you know, at Q1 last year, which admittedly was a particularly good quarter for Nokia, and it was sort of down for some of the others, they were on 38.8%. So that's a big drop, and if you look at the so that in a chart way, you can see that noticeable dive from Nokia. Now, often you see this from Q4 to Q1 simply because of seasonal sales. That impact's become less as smartphone sales have become more global and sort of not dominated by Western Europe and North America, but nonetheless, it's still there. And I think some of the Nokia decline can be attributed to that, but actually really it's about the intensive competition it's facing. Looking at some of the other figures, it's sort of quite interesting to think, where is that competition coming from? And I think a lot of it comes from actually partly the rise of Android in general, but also it's other manufacturers getting into the market. So, for example, others, which is sort of everyone who's not mentioned in the top six, which is Nokia, Apple, RIM, Samsung, and HTC and Motorola, accounts for in Q1 23 million shipments, almost the same as Nokia itself, and that's a big increase of the sort of proportion of the market from a year ago. So other manufacturers, and so that's all ones like some of the Chinese ODMs and some of the smaller smartphone manufacturers, are starting to have more of an impact, whereas actually the share of people like RIM and Apple have been fairly constant. RIM's down a bit, Apple is a bit more cyclical, and Samsung is up quite a bit, but Samsung, which performing very poorly in sort of previous years, they've only got into smartphones in the last year. But nonetheless, I mean, this figures, I think, show for Nokia why there's been this strategy change to a large extent, that, you know, Symbian wasn't being competitive with Apple, Android, and some of the others as well. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the sort of subsequent quarters. But that sort of gives you a brief summary of these. And if you want to go and have a look on the site, we'll leave a link in the show notes. There's various graphs showing, the changing smartphone market share and actually who's responsible for growing the smartphone market in the previous quarters. And I think, contrary to what a lot of people say, actually, Apple, while they're still growing the market, actually, I think the likes of HTC, Samsung, and the other Android manufacturers have been driving the smartphone growth, particularly in the last three quarters or so, and that really is reflective of the rise of Android in general.
Yeah, I did notice from other sources, Rafe, maybe it was delving deeper into the IDC figures, that looking at the European breakdown, so just smartphone sales in Europe, that Apple have toppled Nokia for the very first time. So although Nokia's on top worldwide, Apple now do seem to be the number one spot in Europe.
Yeah, that's right. Nokia still remain number two, and they've remained number one in sort of the APAC market, and that's becoming in one sense one of the most important markets for them. Particularly, they've been leading growth in China. But yes, I think seeing Nokia knocked off the number one spot in Europe is, you know, a significant milestone. And it's no surprise really to see that it's Apple doing it. I think the big question, sort of looking further forward ahead, is how much will Nokia's share decline in the sort of the transition period to Windows Phone, and then how quickly or will it recover once Windows Phone comes in? And that remains to be seen, because it's, you know, very difficult to predict the future. But I suspect we'll see sort of a base level of Symbian continue for a while. There are some new devices coming along, both the E6 and the X7 announced recently, and some more to come. But also there are, you know, there's a strong demand for some of those mid-tier and lower cost devices, which will remain in place. There will be a gradual decline there, obviously. And I think the big question is how quickly can they bring Windows Phone on stream? And that's really remains to be seen. You know, Windows Phone hasn't been terribly successful so far. A lot of people point at, you know, its sort of place in the market at the moment, and they're saying, you know, very little in the way of sales figures have been released. But I think it's a very different kettle of fish of when Nokia's committing to it so fully compared to, you know, HTC and Samsung, who are more interested in Android, and in Samsung's case Barda as well. So I think Windows Phone is sort of yet to be proven, and, you know, people talk about that as a risk, and certainly it is for Nokia, but the alternative, which was Android, was probably even more unpalatable in some ways. So I think it's dangerous to, you know, say anything writing off Windows Phone at the moment.
Just to pick up on what you're saying, I've been trying a Windows Phone myself, the HD7, thank you, Steve, for the past week. And I mean, yes, we can't write, it's too early to write anything off, but from what I've seen of it so far, it really does have a long way to go before it is as useful as Symbian or Androids. And I just really hope over the next year or two that they can really increase its utility value.
Thank you, David. Yes, I think it's interesting to get another reaction on Windows Phone. Hopefully we can get more from you on that in due course. But it's probably worth pointing out here that by the time Nokia Windows Phone device arrive, we will have a new version, sort of Mango or Windows 7.5 as it's being talked about. And that does fill some of the holes. And I think Steve and I said much the same thing on a previous podcast. The other thing that, of course, it's worth pointing out here that I think it's dangerous sometimes to make a direct comparison between the feature sets of any of the platforms. I mean, doing that on a pure basis would tend to suggest that Symbian is the best simply because some of the features it has is more advanced, but it's really how well you implement the key ones that seems to be making the difference in the sort of competitive battlegrounds. And certainly that's the case with, I think, iPhone, where Apple have concentrated on some of the core features, implemented them very well. And of course, the whole story around apps is a great example of that. You know, all the platforms are capable of supporting third-party apps, but Apple seems to have been able to take the initiative and lead there. So a lot remains to be seen. And I think having played with Windows Phone myself, yes, I can see the gaps, but I can also see the areas, particularly around things like the People Hub and social networking, where it does have a sort of clear advantage over some of its competitors. And needless to say, as we've often said on this podcast, it's not just about the software, it's the hardware and the design of the phone that goes with it. And certainly it's my opinion on some of the current Windows Phone devices, the hardware kind of lets down the software to an extent in terms of being a usable everyday device. But it's good to hear that contribution, David. I'm sure some of the more loyal Symbian fans will be glad to hear your skepticism.
Yeah, in the same way that the Apple iPhone is great for people who are Apple-centric and certainly smartphone newcomers, because everything just works for them without actually needing to stray anywhere near, you know, the sort of advanced functionality and the sort of power user things that us Symbian people have had to do, sometimes through necessity, sometimes because we want to. And the same way, Windows Phone 7 is fine for any Microsoft-centric smartphone newcomers. And even in its current state, it's certainly very usable. For someone who's used to Hotmail and Windows Live and Microsoft Office and Xbox, it's absolutely fine. And many people, including our friend Matt Miller over in the States, still uses Windows Phone 7 day-to-day without any problems. It's just a bit of a problem, or a bit of a wrench coming from Symbian, and some of the things we tend to do with files and folders and beaming stuff around, those are the bits which are actually missing at the moment from Windows Phone, and maybe Nokia will have some say in adding some of them back in again. Who knows? Let's move on. I have to apologise to David. In the last Insight podcast, I rather jumped down your throat criticising your photography skills. But it did have a benefit that it prompted me to write a tutorial entitled Six of the Most Common Camera Phone Mistakes. And I would urge anyone listening to this who's in the slightest bit into casual photography on their Symbian smartphone, or indeed any smartphone, to go and have a look at that. Just to run through the mistakes very quickly. Mistake one, not enough light, which I think is a kind of a factor in those photos that you sent over in terms of actually knowing where the light sources are, making a note that dual LED flash itself isn't that bright, and you really do need some aspect of daylight, and it needs to be roughly behind you. So awareness of light direction. I mentioned the wobbly grip and the overzealous index finger, which doesn't apply to EDOF cameras because they just take very quickly on the one press. But that's a big, big deal for devices like the N8. And so many people take bad photos of the N8 because they're literally jerking the phone down at the moment of capture because they're not using the shutter key properly. Mistake four, make sure you have focus. Obviously, that also doesn't apply to EDOF, but it's so easy to think that you've got focus and you see the reticule's stable and it's not flashing, and you snap away and don't realise it's not green. If it's not green, you're not focused, in which case you're focusing on the background and your subject will be blurry. Mistake five, don't use digital zoom in still photos. Do not use it. It's an absolute killer on almost any camera phone because it just reduces the amount of the sensor being used and you're just lowering quality with no benefit whatsoever. The only time you should use digital zoom is on the N8 and N86 where you've got an intelligent digital zoom in video mode. That is the only time. Apart from that, you should put sellotape over your zoom buttons so that you don't use them by accident. I jest. Mistake number six is just expecting too much, which I think is probably where you fell down, David, in that you were taking something that was a fairly challenging conditions and cropping in and looking at artifacts and perhaps not realizing that a smartphone camera probably wasn't good enough for the task you were expecting it to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did deliberately crop down the photo that I sent to you just to get the size down and everything. Although, yes, when I'm looking at EDOF photos, I do tend to compare the fine detail of autofocus cameras, autofocus photographs, and the fine detail in EDOF, and I compare it and then ultimately find fault.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I think many people do. They think, okay, I've got a camera on my smartphone, and the people around them, they're at an event, they're using standalone cameras, and people get their smartphones out. Oh, I've got a camera, I'll take shots. And then they're horrendously disappointed by the results. Smartphone cameras are a tiny, tiny fraction of the size in terms of sensor, optics, capabilities of standalone cameras. And this is with N8 apart, of course, the N86 may be apart. Most smartphone cameras simply aren't that good. They're good enough for casual snaps, but you can't start cropping in, you can't start zooming in, you can't start snapping away in indeterminate light conditions. You will simply get bad results. So I think lowering expectations sounds like a bit of a cop-out from me and the article, but really that's the way it is. You're at somebody's 50th birthday party. It's an evening event. It's fairly well lit indoors. You're all supping drinks. You go around snapping photographs, and the results are an absolute mess. You cannot do that with a smartphone camera unless it's got Xenon flash. So there we go.
Yeah, I think it's with EDOF pictures. I mean, I think there'll be people who are anti-EDOF will be wanting me to speak up now, so I'll just say something. I mean, I have taken EDOF pictures in outdoor conditions, and when the photo is, say, shrunk down to fit on a web page, it does look nice. Yeah. Your EDOF pictures, testament to your skills, look brilliant. I haven't had them looking as good because it's just, I mean, it's because when I do reviews and I'm looking at how well the camera performs, I will tend to go in and pick apart the fine detail. And that's when I start to feel like, this is looking over-processed.
I think the interesting thing about all this sort of smartphone camera usage is people talk about the abilities and all of that. And I'd agree with what C was saying, obviously, with the sort of standalone cameras that have the bigger sensors and, you know, some of the dedicated onboard extra bits, if you like, that go beyond, you know, the software you'll typically get with a smartphone. But I will say that I think camera phones can actually produce good results in almost any conditions once they're over the maybe the 3 megapixel mark, once they're beyond, you know, a really basic camera. But they are much less forgiving than your sort of standalone camera. And that's sort of true, I think, of any camera. You know, once you start making it better in terms of the sensor, you know, size or the optics or the lens or whatever, You can produce really outstanding results that you can't produce elsewhere, but it also becomes more forgiving at the same time on sort of the basic shots. And so if you mess up the lighting with a good camera, you will still get a usable image, where if you do the same thing with a cheaper camera, regardless of whether it's in a smartphone or not, it then you know, becomes useless. And so I actually think that the biggest factor these days, you know, when we're talking about doing comparisons or which is better than which, I think actually operator error and, you know, the person who's actually using the camera is almost a bigger factor than anything else. Obviously, you know, for the top end, you know, people taking pictures who really know what they're doing, I think, you know, investing in good camera equipment makes a big difference. But I sometimes wonder for everyone else if, you know, just a bit more forethought before the shot, regardless whether you're using a standalone camera or a smartphone, will probably have the biggest difference in results, rather than, you know, buying a more expensive camera phone with a better spec, or, you know, similarly for a standalone camera.
Yeah, I'd still like to get David an N8, though, if you could possibly wing that, Rafe. I think it'll be very interesting to see how David copes with a decent size sensor and Xenon flash. I think your family snaps, David, will be a revelation, trust me.
I wholeheartedly endorse Steve's suggestion.
And many, many people reading the site, obviously, and listening to this podcast also own N8s and are very, very happy with them for that very reason. So I will simply add my vote to the number. Now, there's a new story coming out of EE Times. This is one that Rafe can comment on, hopefully. They're reporting from the Multicore Expo in California, in the context of which many mobile operating systems support dual-core processors. But the article they've put up, and Rafe will put a link in the show notes, the article reports that a Windows phone that Nokia used to use in its new range of smartphones did have multi-core support, but the report says here that Microsoft had removed it for Windows Phone 7 in order to get the OS to market more quickly. And they're basically saying in the article, Nokia's multi-core devices, smartphones, will be delayed because Microsoft have pulled support in the OS. Do you want to comment on that, Rafe?
I think this is an interesting one. I'm not sure the story is particularly accurate. I mean, commenting first from the Symbian side of things, in this article they mentioned Symbian 4, which is a bit of a danger signal to me in terms of they're not really sure what they're talking about. But we've been told several times, including post February the 11th, that Symbian multi-core devices are on the way, and I'd really expect them for sort of Q3, Q4 of this year. And they're going to be kind of the last new hardware family, if you like, that we'll see from Symbian, and that will include, you know, a graphics coprocessor. I've said before that I expect that to be the ST Ericsson, the sort of U8500 with the Mali graphics coprocessor, and I haven't heard anything recently to change my mind on that particular thing. So we will see multi-core devices from Nokia in that respect. Turning specifically to Windows Phone, I'm not even sure the reporting is particularly accurate here. It's true to say that Windows Phone 7 doesn't have multi-core at the moment, and there's a chassis specification which, for those that don't know, is kind of like the standard set of specs that Windows Phone 7 devices have, and certainly in the first generation they weren't there. Now, whether that was done in order to get them to the market on time, it's probably difficult to say. At that point, multi-core was only just coming in, and so I suspect the thought was we can do a generation without multi-core. And for anyone who's used a Windows Phone 7 device, I don't think complaining about the fluidity of the UI or the speed performance is really going to be a problem for the most part. But also looking in terms of the technical aspects of this, Windows Phone 7 is effectively based on Windows Embedded Compact 7 Core, which is kind of Microsoft's, if you like, OS for embedded and compact devices. Used to be known as WinCE, and still is. There's kind of a changeover going on at the moment. And multi-core is in fact supported by Windows Embedded Compact 7 Core. And so it's very likely that sort of future versions of Windows Phone 7 will be supporting multi-core, and that will be needed to sort of be specified in the chassis specification. And without actually knowing anything specific on this, or I would strongly suspect that one of the top-end Windows Phone 7.5 or Mango chassis will support multi-core processors. It's quite clearly on the roadmap. So I think this EE Times report is probably causing a bit of trouble unnecessarily. And just as a final point on all this, I'd remind that a multi-core is not a feature point that should necessarily be taken as a simple, that's a good thing. You want a processor that will give you the optimum performance between battery life and sort of speed of doing tasks on the phone itself. So, you know, it's no good having a multi-core stick on the outside. It doesn't make your phone any shinier or whatever. There needs to be a practical reason to do so. And I think all the Symbian devices have proved that, you know, having a processor that's considered way below sort of market average, particularly with things like the N8 and C7 with their processors. It doesn't necessarily mean you need a fast processor to have decent performance. Now, a lot of people still feel the Symbian devices are underpowered, but I'd tell them to look at some of the recent software coming out in terms of QML and Qt and match that up against anything that their competition offers. And I think the performance there, that argument kind of goes away. Way too much emphasis is put on clock speed on processors, and the same goes for multi-core. And I think a lot of the time it's just marketing hype and people who want to have the fastest or the shiniest phone. There is obviously a practical reasons for it too, but we can get into that another time.
Yeah, the big thing for with the clock speeds and dual cores is probably impact on web browsing performance. One thing I have been looking at the reviews of things like the Samsung Galaxy 2 S2 and the LG Optimus 2X, which I had here, both dual core processors, and the speed of web page handling is really, really phenomenal. And it's the one area where I think Symbian's traditionally been let down. People criticize web over and over again, and it's not just the web browser, there's the web runtime, which things like Nokia Social run on, and that's all impacted by the raw web performance. And I think that's something that dual core would speed up.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, web can be quite a processor intensive thing, especially if you're doing heavy JavaScript or Flash or something like that, but for the most part it's not too bad. I mean, you need to look at the speed of things like Opera or Opera Mini, and they're running on relatively low resources and yet are able to squeeze out very good performance, but obviously performance in something like web is always going to be a combination of multiple factors. I think the rendering of the web page, obviously there is a direct measurable relationship between processor speed and things like that, but I'd actually be a bit skeptical to make a general point that multi-core will give you faster web performance. I think for most people the bottleneck will actually be bandwidth coming down onto the phone from their network via 3G or whatever, and there are some differences if you then start doing things with JavaScript and Flash, but for the most part you can optimize the software much more readily and have an impact improving web performance than you can by putting a fast processor in a phone. But that's just my opinion.
And just as a general point, something we always like to do here at All About Symbian is to put things in context and proportion. I think a message people should keep in mind about this is don't panic, because when Nokia did the deal with Microsoft, it wasn't just Nokia and Microsoft that are involved. There is going to be a ripple effect. And for example, a contact I have told me that ST Ericsson in their last redundancy round had actually let go of a lot of Windows Phone people, and then they were caught on the hop when this deal was announced. So they need to build up their expertise again because they don't have the talent there. So it's understandable there are going to be delays while everyone gets adjusted to the new environment.
Yeah, everything keeps changing. That's certainly going to be something that's been true over the last few years in the mobile industry and will carry on being true. I was talking with Miriam Joire, Tank Girl, from Gadget Mobile yesterday on the Phone Show Chat podcast. Go listen to it, plug. And we were absolutely amazed by the speed of the mobile industry over the last few years. And now you can kind of go to bed at night and wake up in the morning and there's another 100 Google Reader articles and 3 more phones have been launched and 2 new technologies. And it's just overwhelming sometimes. But we will try and keep on top of it here in All About Symbian, or All About whatever we end up becoming by the end of the year, how we choose to handle things. And there's more from that on by Rafe in the coming months. And let's move on to other subjects. Autumn Dynasty is a new real-time strategy game that aims to strip away things like all the number crunching and all the geeky technicalities and just make real-time strategy fun again. David, does it work?
Not quite, although it should, is the one sentence takeaway. Yes, as you're saying, Autumn Dynasty is a real-time strategy game, but when we say real-time, we mean that it's not you take a turn and the computer takes a turn. No, everything's happening at once. Autumn Dynasty looks beautiful. It's all done in a hand-drawn feel, so you have like hand-drawn little representations of military units that you've created and maps that you're battling for. And it looks really good, and it's easy to control. All you have to do is select a unit and swipe your finger across the screen to tell them what path you want to take, where you want them to go and attack, and you get a little circle to show their area of effect. There's some really good help pages to tell you how to play the game, although unfortunately all the units have a special ability, which are not mentioned at all, so you end up having to work out, trying to guess what all the effects are, and not all of them are obvious, actually.
You'd have thought there'd be some kind of guide on their website, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but I haven't seen anything. But the main problems with it is that there's no linear progression. There's just a set of maps in the game, but you can choose to play whatever you're in the mood for. There's two maps that are classed as easy difficulty, two at medium and one at hard. So that makes only five maps. And even on the hard map, I have yet to lose a game to the artificial intelligence. So I think there's not enough variety and it's a little too easy. But otherwise, it looks great. And it does strip away all the complicatedness that you get in RTS games. So almost a qualified recommendation for me. But they just need a bit more content in there, I think.
Yeah, I think you mentioned the music, which you couldn't turn off, which I'm absolutely with you. I hate music, which is... Which is constant and just drives you mad after all. Does it have any sound effects? Like when people die, you get, lemmings like, you get...
I think that's another bug in the game, actually, because when you pause the game, there are two tick boxes for sound and music. Now, I've never heard a sound effect while I'm playing this game, but the music will not shut up. and it doesn't matter which combination of ticks I do, I haven't heard any sound effects and I can't make the music stop. So I think there's supposed to be sound effects, but they're not working.
Yeah, sounds like poor quality control. I'm sure there's an update in the works from them. Also released recently from Forum Nokia, the Symbian 3 SDK 1.0, finally out, targeted developers using native code, that's C++, Java, web runtime and so on, to create applications for Symbian. Version 1.0 adds, Rafe, do you want to give the change log?
It adds support for VGA resolution, so that's so you can do testing for devices like the Nokia E6 with the new resolution. It's an updated version of the browser, that's going to be important for web runtime testing, as well as some extra new APIs, OpenWF support, SQLite 3 and a number of others. Really, this is just the SDK for those that are continuing with either, really Symbian C++ development, but people who are doing Java and web runtime development can also use this SDK. And this is obviously in contrast to the Qt SDK, which also got released. We'll talk about that in a minute. Given the what was said a year ago, or it wasn't a year ago, it was sort of back in November last year, about Qt becoming the sort of the primary development environment for Symbian. Obviously, with the February 11th changes, there are some changes to that, and I suspect we'll see Symbian C++ being supported to the end of the lifetime of Symbian as a platform. And this is sort of the first final release, really, of the SDK for Symbian 3 1.0. There's been various sort of, if you like, pre-1.0 versions available that people have been using for development on the N8 and the C7, but you know, it's finalized everything here. So if you're still a Symbian C++ developer, this is the SDK you want. But I think this is really a leftover, sort of a legacy of the past. And really, I think the fact that we've got both a Symbian C++ SDK and sort of Qt going on at the same time, it talks to one of the problems that, of course, the Symbian platform had with the difficulty in attracting developers and the difficulty in actually creating applications. Something of an irony here is this has largely been solved now with the release of the Qt SDK, so we'll mention that in a minute. But this Symbian 3 SDK, for those who are continuing with the Symbian C++ development, of whom there are quite a few out there, we're continuing to see applications develop using this and lots of games and applications still being added to the Obby store. But yes, this is, I suspect, will be one of the final releases of this SDK. We'll probably see updates for, you know, the final batch of phones, but after that it will be into maintenance mode.
Yeah, there's anybody watching the Obby store over the last few weeks will have noticed a whole flurry of Qt applications, apps built on Qt, and specifically applications with QML after their title, indicating they're written in Qt Quick, which is kind of a rapid application development system built on top of Qt. And as Rafe just mentioned, the Qt SDK 1.1 is now out. So what's the brief change log for that?
Well, you were talking about Qt Quick and QML there, and they're really tools that are within this new SDK. It's basically a declarative UI that enables you to create nice looking UIs very quickly, and particularly you can actually use QML in combination with web technologies, as a bit of JavaScript, HTML, to sort of create these standalone applications. There's some great examples from someone called Tommy Laukinen for sort of Facebook, Twitter and Google Reader, which we'll be featuring on the site in due course. But this SDK is also delivering the Qt 4.7, which is kind of the latest version. As I say, it's important with this Qt Quick, but it's also the latest versions of Qt Mobility. So in many ways, what you're getting with this Qt SDK 1.1 is sort of a mature version of Qt that's ready for delivering mobile applications, particularly on Symbian, but it does apply to MIMO and MIGO as well. And again, there's something of an irony here that, you know, this is now ready to go really for this kind of development. And I titled the news story on this sort of Qt comes of age on mobile. And I do think that's true. But of course, it's all has to be put in the context of the switch over to Windows Phone. And Qt isn't going on to Windows Phone. There are some questions about what will be happening to Qt within Nokia, some talk about maybe it being ported to Series 40. But nonetheless, there is now a very capable and an easy to use development environment sitting on top of Symbian. And as we've said several times before, there are plenty more devices to come. So there are developers taking advantage of this. And as you said, the first of these QML applications have now appeared in the Ovi store, and I'd expect more to appear in the weeks and the months to come. There's sort of if you like, a double-edged sword to this release. And yes, it's great to see that it's finally got out there, but I'm sure there'll be plenty of people saying, well, it's a bit irrelevant now that Symbian's been given an end of life. And you know, I think that's absolutely right, although I would, as I say, remind people that there's plenty more life to come. And with the number of devices that Nokia are talking about that are going to be this Qt compatible, there's sort of 100 million out there at the moment, and there's, you know, 150 million or so to come, and that's actually more than many of the competing platforms can boast on their own in a similar time frame. So there's still a big opportunity out there, at least that's what Nokia would say. But I can certainly understand developers who are reluctant to invest money into this because they sort of see an end of the road for Symbian. I think the truth probably sitting somewhere in between. If you want to create something for Symbian phones, Qt is going to be the way to do it in the next couple of years. And there's certainly going to still be demand for people to do that, both from external companies and one-man bands. A lot of developers, as we know, sort of develop for their phone because they want to rather than because they have to. It's interesting talking to some of the sort of third-party companies that do development on demand, if you like. They're saying they're seeing a lot of interest in Symbian and Qt because there are people who want to have a complete offering across all platforms. Sure. And so as external consultants, they're seeing a real interest and a pickup in demand for Qt now that this sort of final release is out there, and it's a lot more capable, and actually it's rapid development, and yeah, you can now produce a Symbian version of your cross-platform application far more quickly than you could before. And you know, it's ticking the boxes. So interesting release, and great to actually finally see it get out there.
Yeah. Is it fair to say, Rafe, I mean, if you cast your mind back to the early 2000s, even late 1990s, we had Scion, which became Symbian, Scion Software, had this OPL language, just rapid application development environment, actually sitting on the device. Now, QML doesn't sit on the device. Qt Quick is a desktop side system. But would you compare it to OPL? Would you say it's like a modern day version, something where novices can create applications which instantly look like professional applications?
Certainly in the sense that I think it's much easier to get into, and that novices could potentially create applications without too much work. I think the important thing to realise, you know, is that the world has changed immeasurably in terms of the capabilities and what you can expect to do. And so OPL was a basic-like language with all of that implied in terms of the limitations. And obviously something like Qt and Qt Quick is very much web-aware, ready for the multimedia world, something which OPL was never really able to address effectively. But yes, I mean, it's probably fair to say that you could pick up and use Qt Quick in particular relatively easily. I don't think the sort of barriers to entry are quite as low as something like OPL. You know, if people want to do that kind of thing, I'd actually recommend they look at the web runtime stuff. That's probably the easiest way to get an application up and running. But nonetheless, in terms of getting a slick looking UI, you know, a sort of modern looking smartphone application, I think of all the platforms, probably Qt is probably the easiest way to do it, particularly if you have a bit of existing knowledge of either web technologies, say for QML, JavaScript and HTML, you can create some applications, mentioned a few of those earlier, or, you know, with a bit of C++ experience with or Qt experience, yes, you can create very nice looking applications very easily.
I think there's two sides to this rapid development and convenient and easy development, though, because I mean, all of us, all about Symbian, we're going through a lot of applications looking for things to review and choosing what we will and won't talk about. And over the past few months, I have seen a definite drop in the quality of applications, and there's a lot more that I'm having to just reject because they're just unusable. So what have both of you found?
I would say that the quality has been variable over the last 2 years. Obviously, there have been lots of RSS, wizard apps. There have been apps written in web runtime. There are simply just apps which are native C++, but complete rubbish. I think the fraction of good to bad, it remains about the same from my point of view. Ray?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think if the trend I'd pick out with sort of cute applications coming out, there's probably been more very good applications, but sort of been an equal number of poor applications, and perhaps they're more noticeable because there's just more applications coming out in general. Certainly in terms of the number of things being added to Ovisor, there's been quite a pickup since the beginning of the year. That's increasing and has continued to do so. I suspect with this Qt SDK 1.0 out, that will continue. But, you know, looking back recently, there's been some really great Qt applications that have emerged. And I think it's difficult to say whether there's been any change in the proportion. I'd say, if anything, there's more high quality applications, but maybe that's just as the fact there's more applications altogether.
Yeah. Now, David, the timing of these Qt releases was quite important for you. You've been having problems with an application which wouldn't install, but the Qt runtimes were able to come to your rescue?
Yes, that's right. It's my Nokia C7, which I use for my reviews. I'm still not 100% sure what caused the problem, but I was having a problem where applications were either failing to install or said they were installed, but the icon was nowhere to be found. Autumn Dynasty was one of them, actually. I couldn't get that installed. And it's tricky to try and reinstall things on the Ovistore when the Ovistore says they're installed. I tried doing a soft reset, which is *#7370#, and I still had the same problem. I looked on the Betalab site because I tried to keep clear of test software on this review fund so that it stays in good working order, although I had been trying Nokia Sleeping Screen. There was no mention of problems on the page for that, but on Nokia Bubbles, they do have a little sys file you can download and install called Qt Downgrade. So obviously these Betalabs projects do modify the Qt libraries a little bit. Yeah, so I tried that and that didn't help. So I did another soft reset. I wanted to avoid doing the hard reset because of the problems that we have. And what I ended up doing was I booted into Windows and I installed the SDK 1.1, and there are options to install Qt Mobility and Qt WebKit, and I followed the procedure of doing a soft reset, installing the Qt libraries from the SDK, and then resetting the phone, and then installing the Ovistore, and everything was fine again. And I'll have an editorial about that on the website by the time people hear this. So I'd like to know if people have had similar problems and if this works for them or if they have other solutions.
And just to comment, the reason that this happens is I think it's the Qt Smart Installer sometimes gets confused about what components it's supposed to be installing and can sometimes sort of break an installation. So if this does happen, the first place to check is actually whether there's a Qt Smart Installer installation to continue. That will show up as an icon in your application screen, but obviously David managed to break it more thoroughly. I'm not quite sure how. It's to get all the sort of various bits of Qt, and he mentioned there Qt, so that would be Qt 4.7.3, Qt Mobility 1.03, and Qt WebKit. If you install all of those separately, you should be able to fix your Qt installation. I know that Nokia are aware of this issue, and I think they'll probably look at getting bug fixes into the smart installer process to make sure they get this fixed as soon as possible. I haven't seen very many people report this particular issue, and it doesn't actually break the phone. It just tends to mean you have a failed installation, and if you try and install that app later on, it doesn't work and you can't find the app in the app manager to uninstall it. So I know it's had led to some frustration for some people, but just to explain that there is some technical background to that, and it's not breaking the phone as such. It just seems to be a smart installer issue.
Yes, that's definitely right, because I did have a smart installer icon up, and sometimes it would say no pending installations, or it would try and installing it and then say installation failure.
Thanks, David. There'll be more from him and probably from me in terms of Qt installation and troubleshooting. As soon as we puzzle things out, we will put up a tutorial at allaboutsymbian.com. We are out of time, guys, so I'm going to wrap things up here. You can find links to all the things we've been talking about in the show notes at allaboutsymbian.com. You can catch us on Twitter at AAS. And also at Rafe Blandford, at David Gilson, and at Steve Litchfield. Goodbye, Dan in Sussex from...
Goodbye, everybody, from me, Rafe Blandford.
Yeah, and goodbye up in Hull.
And goodbye from me, David Gilson.
Yeah, we will all catch you next week, and probably have Ewan back as well, fresh from Eurovision. So we'll see you then on the All About Symbian Insight. Bye for now.